The rising sun flared upon the mountain tops and set them aflame. Far out beyond the low rocks of the island, a sail glinted on the darkling waters, and then another, and as the circle of their vision expanded, a dozen more. Hal slapped Abberly lightly on the shoulder. "It is time to go to work, old friend," he said, and slid down the shrouds. As his feet hit the deck, he called to the helm, "Up anchor, Mr. Tyler! All hands aloft to set sail!" Released from restraint, the Golden Bow spread her canvas and wheeled away. The waters rustling under her bows and her wake creaming behind her, she sped out from her ambush behind Dalak Island. The light was bright enough by now for Hal to make out clearly his quarry scattered across the wind-flecked waters ahead. He looked eagerly for the piled canvas of a tall ship amongst them, but saw only the single lateen sails of the Arabian dhows. The closest of these vessels seemed unalarmed by the Golden Bow's appearance, her high pyramid of sails standing right across the entrance to Adulis Bay. They held their course, and as the frigate bore down upon the nearest of them, Hal saw the crew and passengers lining the dhow's side and peering across at them. Some had scampered up the stubby mast and were waving a greeting. Hal stopped beside the helm and said to Ned Tyler, "'Tis likely that they have seen only one other ship like ours in these waters, and that's the Gull. They take us for an ally.' He looked up to where his topmastman hung in the rigging, ready to handle the great mass of canvas. Then he looked back along the deck, where the gunners were fussing over the culverins and the powder boys were scurrying up from below decks with their deadly burdens. "'Mr. Fisher,' he called, "'load one battery on each side with ball, all the others with chain and grape, if you please.' Big Daniel grinned with black and rotten teeth and knuckled his brow. Hal wanted simply to disable the enemy vessels, not sink or burn them. Even the smallest and poorest of those craft must be worth a great deal to the exchequer of his most Christian majesty if he could capture them and deliver them to Admiral Senec at Mitsiwa. The battery on each side loaded with ball would be held in reserve. The first dhow was so close ahead that Hal could see the expressions on the faces of her crew. They were a dozen or so sailors, dressed in ragged and faded robes and haik turbans. Most were still smiling and waving, but the old man at the tiller in the stern was looking about wildly, as if to seek some providential escape from the tall hull that was racing down upon his little vessel. "Break out our colours, if you please, Mr. Tyler," Hal ordered, and watched the Croix Patée unfurl alongside the white Coptic cross of the Empire on its royal blue ground. The dismay on the faces of the dhow's crew as they saw the cross of their doom spread before their eyes was pathetic to behold, and Hal gave his next order. "Run out your guns, Master Daniel!" The Golden Bow's gun ports crashed back, and the howl reverberated to the rumble of the guns as the culverins poked out their bronze muzzles. "I'll pass the chase close to starboard. Fire as you bear, Master Daniel." Big Daniel raced to the bows and took command of the number one starboard battery. Hal saw him move swiftly from gun to gun to check their laying, inserting the wedges to lower the aim. They would be firing almost directly down into the dhow as they swept past her. The Golden Bow rushed down silently upon the little craft, and Hal said quietly to the helm, "Slowly bring her up a point to larboard." As they realized the menace of the gaping guns, the crew of the dhow fled from the rail and flung themselves down behind the stubby little mast or crouched behind the bales and casks that cluttered her deck. The first battery fired together in one smoking, thunderous discharge, and every shot struck home. The base of the mast was blown away in a storm of white wood splinters, and her rigging crashed down to hang overside in an untidy tangle of rope and canvas. The old man at the tiller disappeared, as though turned to air by a wizard's spell. He left only a red smear on the torn planking. "Avast firing!" Hal bellowed, to make himself heard in the ear-numbing aftermath of the gunfire. The dhow was crippled. Her bows were already swinging away before the wind. The tiller shot away and her mast gone overboard. The Golden Bow left her rolling in her wake. "Hold your course, Mr. Tyler." The Golden Bow tore straight at the flotilla of small craft strewn across the blue waters ahead. These had seen the merciless treatment of the first dhow and the imperial colours flying at the frigate's masthead, and now every one put his helm hard up and came round before the wind. Goose-winged, they fled before the golden bow's charge. "Steer for the vessel dead ahead," said Hal quietly, and Ned Tyler brought the frigate around a point. The dhow Hal had chosen was one of the largest in sight, and its open deck was crowded with men. There must be at least 300 packed into her, Hal estimated. It was a short voyage across the narrow sea, and her captain had taken a risk. She was carrying far more troops than was prudent. A thin shout of defiance reached Hal's ears as they closed the range.
"Allah Akbar! God is great!"
Steel war helmets glinted on the heads of the Omani troops, and they brandished their long, curved scimitars. There came an untidy volley of musket fire aimed at the frigate, the popping of the jezzles and puffs of gun smoke along the dhow's side. A lead ball thudded into the mast above Hal's head. "Every man aboard her is a soldier," Hal said aloud. He did not have to add that if they were allowed to reach the western shore of the sea, they would march against Judith Nazet. "Give her a volley of ball. Sink her, Master Daniel." The heavy iron cannonballs raked the troopship from deck to keel, and split her like kindling under the axe. The sea rushed in through her torn belly. She capsized, and the water was suddenly filled with the bobbing heads of struggling, drowning men. "Steer for that vessel with the silver pennant." Hal did not look back, but tore through the fleet like a barracuda into a shoal of flying fish. Not one could outrun him. With her mountain of white sails driving her, the Golden Bough flew upon them as if they were at anchor, and her guns crashed out in flame and smoke. Some of the little ships burst open and sank. Others were left in the frigate's wake, with masts snapped away and sails dragging alongside. Some of the sailors threw themselves overboard at the moment that the culverins came to bear upon them. They preferred the sharks to the blast of guns. Several ran for the nearest island and tried to anchor in the shoal waters where the Golden Bough could not follow. Others deliberately ran aground, and their crews dived overboard to swim and wade to the beach. Only those ships furthest to the east and closest to the Arabian coast had the head start to run from the frigate's charge. Hal looked astern and saw the water behind him dotted with the floundering hulls of those he had overtaken. Every mile he chased the survivors eastwards was a mile further from Mitsiwa. "None of those will come back in a hurry," he said grimly, as he watched them fly in confusion. "Mr. Tyler, please be good enough to wear the ship around and lay her close-hauled on the starboard tack." This was the Golden Bough's best point of sailing. "There is no dhow built in all Arabia that can point higher into the wind than my darling can," Hal said aloud, as he saw 20 sail to windward, trying to escape by beating up into the west. The Golden Bough tore back into the scattered fleet, and now some of the dhows dropped their wide triangular mainsails as they saw him coming, and screamed to Allah for mercy. Hal checked the frigate as he came alongside each of these, bringing her head to the wind as he launched a boat and sent a prize crew comprising one white seaman and 6 of his Amadoda to board the surrendered ship. "If there's nothing of value in her cargo, take off her crew and put a torch to her." By late that afternoon, Hal had 5 large dhows on tow behind the Golden Bough, and another 7 sailing in company with him, under jury rigging and with his prize crews aboard, as they headed back towards Mitsiwa. Every one of the captured vessels was heavily laden with vital provisions of war. Behind him, the sky was dulled with the smoke of the burning hulls, and the sea was littered with the wreckage. General Nazet sat on her black Arabian stallion and watched from the clifftops as this untidy flotilla straggled into Mitsiwa roads. At last she closed her telescope and remarked to Admiral Senek beside her, "I see why you call him El Tazar. This Englishman is a barracuda indeed." Then she turned away her face so that he could not see the thoughtful smile that softened her handsome features. "El Tazar. It is a good name for him," she thought. And then, irrelevantly, another notion occurred to her. "I wonder if he is as fierce a lover as he is a warrior." It was the first time since God had chosen her to lead his legions against the pagan that she had looked at any man through a woman's eyes. Colonel Cornelius Schroeder dismounted in front of the spreading tent of shimmering red and yellow silk. A groom took his horse, and he paused to look around the encampment. The royal tent stood on a small knoll overlooking Adulis Bay. Up here the sea breeze cooled the air and made it possible to breathe. On the plain below, where the army of Islam was bivouacked around the port of Zula, the stones crackled in the heat and shimmered in the mirage. The bay was crowded with shipping, but the tall masts of the Gull of Moray dominated all others. The Earl of Cumbrae's ship had come in during the night, and now Schroeder heard his voice raised in argument within the silken tent. His lips twitched in a smile that lacked humour, and he adjusted the hang of the golden sword at his side before he strode to the flap of the tent. A tall Subadar bowed to him. All the troops of Islam had come to know him well. In the short time he had served with them, Schroeder's feats of daring had become legend in the Mogul's army. The officer ushered him into the royal presence. The interior of the tent was commodious and sumptuously furnished. The entire floor was thickly covered with gorgeously coloured silk carpets, and silken draperies formed a double skin that kept out the sun's heat. The low tables were of ivory and rare wood, and the vessels upon them were of solid gold. The great Mogul's brother, the Maharaja Sadiq Khan Jahan, sat in the centre of a pile of silk cushions. He wore a tunic of padded yellow silk and striped pantaloons of red and gold. The slippers on his feet were scarlet with long curling toes and buckles of gold. His turban was yellow and secured above his brow by an emerald the size of a walnut. He was close-shaven, with only a coal line of fine moustache upon the petulant upper lip. Across his lap was a scimitar in a scabbard so richly encrusted with jewels that the sparkle of them pricked the eye. On one gloved hand he held a falcon, a magnificent saker of the desert. He lifted the bird and kissed its beak as tenderly as if it had been a beautiful woman. Or rather, Schroeder thought bleakly, as if it were one of his pretty dancing boys. A little behind him, on another pile of cushions, sat Ahmed El Grang, the left hand of Allah. He was so wide-shouldered as to seem deformed, and his neck was thick and corded with muscle. He wore a steel war helmet, and his beard was dyed with henna, red as that of the prophet. His massive chest was covered with a steel cuirass, and there were bracelets of steel upon his wrists. His brows beetled, and his eyes were as cold and implacable as those of an eagle. Behind this ill-matched pair sat a host of courtiers and officers, all richly dressed. Before the prince knelt a translator, who, his forehead pressed to the ground, was trying to keep up with the buzzard's flood of invective. The buzzard stood before the prince with his fists bunched on his hips. On his head was his beribboned bonnet, and his beard was more bushy and fiery than the dyed, barbered curls that covered El Grang's chin. He wore half-armour above his plaid. He turned with relief when Schroeder entered the tent and made deep and respectful obeisance, first to the prince and then to El Grang.
"Jesus love you, Colonel. I need you now to talk some sense into these two lovely laddies. This ape," Cumbrae spurned the grovelling translator with his boot, "this ape is blethering away and making a nonsense of what I'm telling them."
He knew that Schroeder had spent many years in the Orient, and that Arabic was one of the languages in which he was fluent.
"Tell them that I came here to take prizes, not to match my gull against a ship of equal force and have her shot away beneath my feet," the buzzard instructed him. "They want me to do battle with the golden bow."
"Explain the matter to me more fully," Schroeder invited. "That way I may be able to assist you."
"The golden bow has arrived in these waters. We must presume under the command of young Courtney," the buzzard told him.
Schroeder's face darkened at the name.
"Will we never be rid of him?" "It seems not," Cumbrae chuckled. "In any event, he's flying the white cross of the Empire, and whaling into El Grang's transports with a vengeance. He's sunk and captured 23 sail in the last week, and no Mussulman captains will put out to sea while he's in the offing. Single-handed, he's blockading the entire coast of Ethiopia.
He shook his head in reluctant admiration.
From the cliffs above Tenwera, I watched him fall upon a flotilla of El Grang's war dhows. He cut them to pieces. But Jesus, he handles his ship as well as Frankie ever could. He sailed circles around those Mussulmen and shot them out of the water. The entire fleet of Allah, the All-Merciful, is all bottled up in the port, and El Grang is starved of reinforcements and stores. The Mussulmen call young Courtney El Tazar, the Barracuda, and not one will go out to face him.
Then his grin faded, and he looked lugubrious. The golden bow is bright and clean of weed. My gull has been at sea for nigh on 3 years. Her timbers are riddled with shipworm. I would guess that even in my best point of sailing, the golden bow has at least 3 knots of speed on me.
What do you want me to tell his highness? Schroeder asked scornfully. That you are afraid to meet this young Courtney?
I am afraid of no man living, or dead for that matter. But there's no profit in it for me. Hal Courtney has nothing I want. But if it comes to a single ship fight, he could do me and McGull fearful damage. If they want me to fight him, they will have to sweeten my cup a little.
Schroeder turned back to the prince and explained this to him in carefully chosen diplomatic terms. Sadiq Khan Yahan stroked his falcon as he listened expressionlessly, and the bird ruffled out its feathers and hooded its yellow eyes. When Schroeder had finished, the prince turned to El Grang.
What did you say they called this red-bearded braggart?
They call him the Buzzard, Your Highness, El Grang replied hoarsely.
A name well chosen, for it seems he prefers to pick out the eyes of the weak and the dying, and scavenge the leavings of fiercer creatures, rather than to kill for himself. He is no falcon.
El Grang nodded agreement, and the prince turned back to Schroeder.
Ask this noble bird of prey what payment he demands for fighting El Tazar.
Tell the pretty boy I want a lakh of rupees in gold coin, and I want it in my hands before I leave port,
Cumbrie replied. And even Schroeder gasped at the audacity.
1 lakh was 100,000 rupees.
The buzzard went on amiably.
You see, I've got the prince with his bum in the air and his pantaloons round his ankles. I intend to tap him full length, but not the way he likes it.
Schroeder listened to the prince's reply, then turned back to Cumbrie.
He says that you could build 20 ships like the Gal for a lock.
That may be so, but it won't buy me a pair of balls to replace the ones that Hal Courtney shoots away.
The prince smiled at this response.
Tell the buzzard he must have lost them long ago, but he makes a fine eunuch. I could always find a place for him in my harem.
The buzzard guffawed at the insult, but shook his head.
Tell the pretty pederast, no gold, and the buzzard flies away.
The prince and El Grang whispered to each other, gesticulating. At last they seemed to reach a decision.
I have another proposition that the bold captain might find more to his taste. The risk he takes will not be so great, but he will receive the luck he demands.
The prince rose to his feet, and all his court fell upon their knees and pressed their foreheads to the ground.
I will leave Sultan Ahmed El Grang to explain this to you in secrecy.
He retired through the curtains at the back of the tent, and all his retinue went with him, leaving only the 2 Europeans and the Sultan in the cavern of silk. El Grang gestured to both men to come closer and to sit in front of him.
What I have to say is for the ears of no other living soul.
While he arranged his thoughts, he fingered the old lance wound that ran in a ridge of raised scar tissue from below his ear down under the high collar of his tunic. Half his vocal cords had been severed by that old injury. He began to speak in his hoarse, wheezing voice.
The Emperor was slain before Suakin, and his infant son Iyasu has inherited the crown of Prestonjohn. His armies were in disarray when there arose a female prophet who proclaimed that she had been the chosen by the Christian God to lead his armies. She came down from the mountains, leading 50,000 fighting men, and carrying before her a religious talisman that they call the Tabernacle of Mary. Her armies, inspired by religious fanaticism, were able to check us at Mitziwa. Both Schroeder and Cochrane nodded. This was nothing new. Now Allah has given me the opportunity to seize both this talisman and the person of the infant emperor. El Grung sat back and lapsed into silence, watching the faces of the two white men shrewdly. With the tabernacle and the emperor in your hands, the enemies of Nazet would dissolve like the snow in the summer sun, Schroeder said softly. El Grung nodded. A renegade monk has come into us, and offered to lead a small party, commanded by a bold man, to the place where both the talisman and the emperor are hidden. Once the child and the tabernacle have been captured, I will need a fast, powerful ship to carry them to Muscat before Nazet can make an attempt to rescue them from us. He turned to Schroeder and said, You, Colonel, are the bold man I need. If you succeed, your payment will also be a luck. Then El Grung looked at Cochrane. Yours is the fastest ship to carry them to Muscat. When you deliver them there, there will be another luck for you. He smiled coldly. This time I will pay you to fly from El Tazar, rather than confront him. Are your balls big and heavy enough for that task, my brave buzzard?